Well, Ruth has reminded us, I think, that one of the reasons that the liberals do very well is because life is risky. It's shocking, I know, but most of us aren't going to get out of this alive. And because we're not, you can always frighten people about different things. And if you're a liberal with nowhere to go, you worry about it more than conservatives do. The whole question also of the risk versus risk thing, which will be foreshadowed in Steve's presentation after Patrick Michaels, is the issue that our goal is not a safe technology, a safe world. Our goal is a safer world. The world is made safer by allowing dangerous products to exist, unhealthy products to exist, that happen to be safer, less dangerous than the products that we substitute for. It's easy to see that. I mean, there are risks associated with parts per billion of chlorinated hydrocarbons, the things that happen when you chlorinate the water. But there are much greater risks associated with the billions per part of bacterially contaminated water, which most of the world, or much of the world, is still drinking today. Risk-taking, prudent risk-taking, makes the world safer. EPA doesn't realize that. EPA's priority setting, as we'll hear about later, is askew. Bill Riley, who was at EPA for a number of years, a Republican, of course, used to say EPA's policy in setting risk was ready, fire, aim. One person who will help us aim, at least at the subject that was begun to be discussed in some detail by Fred Singer last night, is on global warming, Patrick Michaels. Fred was at Kyoto. I was at Kyoto. Fred only began to touch upon the absurdity of that children's crusade. The line, the story that I remembered most from it, and there were so many, was at a conference by a group who had trained into Kyoto. Well, they'd taken the ferry over from China, but trains are better than planes. Walking's better than trains. Staying at home, which they didn't do, would have been better yet. There was a Siberian there, a very irate Russian ecologist. And he says, I Russian, I Siberian, and Western capitalism, technology, evil, bad, bad, bad. When I, young man in Siberia, in my country, 9 months winter, now because of evil technology, Western civilization, global warming, only 7 months winter. I said, oh, my God, we're in trouble. But luckily, most of us go to Florida rather than to Duluth, Minnesota when we retire. Most of America and the world are with us. And Patrick Michael will give you some idea why they should be with us, why the science of global warming is quite great. Michael is down at the University of Virginia. He has spent the last 4 years, 5 years, 6 years taking the intellectual ideas that explain what's really going on in global warming and developing, I think, one of the more articulate, effective ways of trying to communicate to the American people what's at stake when science goes awry in the important area of climate change. Michael.
Thank you. It's always nice to talk to an audience that's not composed mainly of scientists. When I talked to my colleagues at the University of Virginia and mentioned the concept of public choice theory, which is what is really driving the global warming hysteria, not one of them has ever said they have ever heard of public choice theory, but of course that is what is driving this. This is a classic example. If you were the administrator of NASA and I were the chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Science, Technology, and Space, I asked you, was global warming such an important problem that you needed $2.1 billion more of money for NASA research? You would tell me yes. When you turn to your employees and said, I need research proposals, they would all tell you, here are our research proposals about this important problem. When the scientists that you funded publish the papers, they will all say it's an important problem, and you have created a paradigm. Unfortunately, public choice buys paradigms in science. It does not buy them forever. That's the nice thing about science. Science will approach a truth via distortions in the public choice sphere, and I'd like to talk to you about that for a sec. Here's a classic example of public choice. These are our friends at the United Nations who attempted in 1990 to produce the so-called consensus of scientists on the issue of global climate change. Anybody who thinks there's a consensus of scientists on any interesting scientific issue has never been to a faculty meeting. But what they did was they released this rather important statement. When the latest atmospheric models are run with the present concentrations of greenhouse gases, Their simulation of climate is generally realistic on large scales. So it was the consensus of this group of public choice servants that the computer models that we had in 1990 were predicting, if you change the greenhouse effect in them, a climate that was generally realistic. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the greenhouse effect before we go on. It's a very real thing. And if you want to lose the argument on global climate change, make the argument that's being made by a lot of people that the human contribution to the greenhouse effect is only 3% of the total greenhouse effect. That is an absolutely silly argument, because what the human contribution is doing is putting in carbon dioxide that takes several years to get out of the atmosphere. We are changing it, and you cannot get away from that. Having established that, you might want to realize the way the greenhouse effect works. The greenhouse effect takes the radiation that comes off the ground. The sun heats the ground. Ground radiates in the infrared. Molecules, carbon dioxide, particularly trap that radiation, and they can either re-radiate it back down or they can send it back up. They've got one of two choices. If it re-radiates back down, the surface or the lower atmosphere gets a little bit warmer. There are other molecules besides carbon dioxide that act just like carbon dioxide for much of the spectrum of the atmosphere. One of those is water vapor. In fact, if you have a wet atmosphere and you change the carbon dioxide greenhouse effect, you don't change the temperature very much. If you have a very dry atmosphere and you change the CO2 greenhouse effect, you do have quite a bit of warming. Well, the driest atmospheres in the world are the coldest atmospheres in the world. Siberia, northwestern North America in the winter. The wettest atmospheres in the world are the summer atmospheres. It was very interesting. I did not realize until I'd read Fred Singer's book that most folks in the early 1950s had dismissed the carbon dioxide greenhouse effect problem because of that water vapor carbon dioxide overlap, as it's caused, that the water vapor in the atmosphere would swamp the CO2 effect. What they didn't realize was the implication. The implication is that if this is true, the very dry air masses, which must be the very coldest air masses, will in fact show warming, while the warmest air masses, the ones you don't want to warm up to create agricultural dislocation and all kinds of disaster, will not warm up very much. In other words, the case could be made very easily as much as 40 years ago that if you changed natural carbon dioxide greenhouse effect, you were going to create a climate that was more salutary for life, more than anything else. Well, the evidence has accrued over the last 4 and 5 decades, and I think the evidence is now indisputable that we did not live in the best of all possible climates. Pangloss did not create the world. People create the world and the atmosphere, ultimately, in their image. And I would like you to see what has been happening over the last 40 years. So I'll go back to my slide. First of all, this may be a real shocker to you, but the United Nations was wrong. The computer models that they say were generally realistic predicted that the planet should have warmed in our hemisphere, the northern hemisphere, about 2.3 degrees Celsius as a result of the changes in the atmosphere. And if you'll help me focus that up, I'd appreciate it. Never get into this argument by saying global warming is not real. There is a real warming, particularly the northern hemisphere here, where we have the better weather stations. It's about 6/10 of a degree Celsius over the course of the last 100 years. This is World War II. Almost all the greenhouse gases went into the atmosphere after World War II. So this warming here before World War II has nothing to do with people. In other words, only about half of this warming could be ascribed to human beings, and that would be a stretch. And that would be about 3/10 of a degree in the last 30 years or so. It's supposed to be 2.3 degrees in our hemisphere. The models that the United Nations used to serve as the basis for the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is easily the most intrusive document we have ever signed with respect to interference with our domestic sovereignty. It is a phenomenal document. I urge you to read it. Though the models that serve that as the basis for that treaty said it should have warmed 2.3 degrees, and instead you had 3/10 of a degree of warming. What about the way it warmed? This is one of my favorite slides. This time I took the winter warming. This is the winter half year, and I flipped the Earth at the equator. By the way, regardless of what our greener friends say, everything in this talk is in the refereed scientific literature, either by myself or from other people. This is from the latest issue of Climate Research, a little paper I put together. We flipped the Earth at the equator, and so we made it winter here and winter here. And what do you see? The redder it is, the warmer it's gotten. The warming is in the dead of Siberia in the winter, in northwestern North America. Those are the driest air masses that we have, and they've warmed up about a degree Celsius, actually somewhere all the way up to 2 degrees. Central Siberia has warmed since World War II from minus 40 to minus 38. Northwestern North America has warmed from minus 35 to minus 34. The rest of this map, if you could be like a Washingtonian and blot out the things you don't want to see. Just take this out of your eye and take this out of your eye, and you'll see there's nothing on the map. What about the summer? It's the summer warming that has to kick in to create the horribly negative effects. This is a summer temperature change. This map is barely pink. Add up all those colors in your eye and take a look, and you're somewhere right to the right of that white. And you don't see very much. Now, remember the theory that the greenhouse effect would warm up the driest air masses? Well, where this map is black, there's no data. By the way, this is the data that is used to generate the global temperature history. This global temperature history stops at 45 degrees south latitude. 1/6 of the world is below 45 degrees south latitude. It stops at 60 degrees north latitude. This is the temperature history that is hyped every year is primarily the history of the land-based temperatures in the northern hemisphere. But anyway, having said what we said about dry air masses being the ones to warm up, there is one hot dry air mass that exists. Most hot air is actually pretty moist, surprisingly so, because the vapor pressure of water is about 10,000 times greater at 40 degrees Celsius than it is at minus 40 degrees Celsius. So to get a really dry, hot atmosphere, you have to have no water available to evaporate. And that here occurs right here in the Sahara. So what we've done with our global climate change, by changing the greenhouse effect, we've raised the temperature of Siberia a couple of degrees. We've ameliorated, we haven't done anything to speak of in the summer except in the Sahara Desert, which we have turned into a desert. It becomes much more striking when you subtract the summer temperature changes from the winter. This isolates out the relative warming in the winter, and you can see what we've done. It's really all dead Siberia here in northwestern North America. Well, there's a problem, as you know. While the records I just showed you were land-based records from 1945 to now, basically the second half of the 20th century, we put up a satellite in 1979 that measures the temperature everywhere. It just doesn't stop where the red and the blue are. It goes all over the place, where the black is, where Siberia is, where Antarctica is. And the satellite since 1979 shows the following global temperature history. Now, unlike some of my government colleagues, I do not put trend lines in data unless things are statistically significant. There's actually a statistically significant but slight decline in the temperatures measured by satellite. Satellite is a fascinating instrument. The head of one of the big environmental organizations in Washington, D.C., at the president's so-called conference on global climate change in October, said, "We've got to do something about the satellite," because this is the attitude when public choice is interfering with science, where the head of a major scientific organization issues a call, a charge, to do something about the satellite. And something, by the way, has been done about the satellite. You will see a news story within the next month that the satellite is drifting ever so closer to the Earth, and therefore it has an artificial cooling trend in it. Well, that's all well and good. These things go off, and they set the computer for the daily weather forecast. They're highly calibrated thermistors, electronic thermometers accelerating upward through the atmosphere. The satellite is a radiometer measuring the vibration of diatomic oxygen looking down through the atmosphere. Two completely different sources of measurement, absolutely and completely different. And between 5,000 and 30,000 feet in the atmosphere, the lineup is absolutely stunning. So the satellite, regardless of what the head of one of these environmental organizations want, will not go down. And that is the problem, one of the problems on this issue. If you look at the satellite data and plot up its trends, it shows a lot of like what the land-based record showed. It shows the warming is concentrated here in the mid-latitudes in the dead of winter. In fact, if we plot it up, this is not global warming. This is a warming of this latitude zone here. This is latitude 30, 35, 40, 45. You are here. You are at the peak of anthropogenerated warming. And it shows itself primarily in the driest air mass, which is primarily in the winter. What a horrible world we're creating. We ought to spend an awful lot of the people's money to stop this terrible problem. Now, a lot of ridicule is directed towards my profession because in the 1970s we said there was global cooling. I've heard that, and I would like to get those people off the hook. Take a close look at the satellite temperature. And what you see, this is the neutral line. These are by latitude bands, North Pole, Arctic Circle, temperate zone, northern hemisphere. Everywhere except for here, it's cooling. So you see, if the greenhouse effect modifies the driest air masses, which are the coldest air masses, which are the air masses that reside in Siberia in northwestern North America. What you have done is you've imposed a slight warming upon a planetary cooling. You can see the cooling on the left. So both of us were right. The problem is that the political process decided the only way to squeeze money out of this very slight change was to magnify it and to trump it up and to clothe it as the devil, when in fact it was the green angel. How does our government lie? This is half of a new paper that's in Nature magazine that was featured by Peter Jennings on ABC News, or on NBC, no, it was Brokaw. Brokaw was gaga on this one. Jennings was gaga over Gore a week ago Saturday night for an entire hour. The biggest hardball question, your friends say you exaggerate. No, not me. Anyway, how could the coal industry put that one out? Well, anyway, this is from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report 2, and is cited, along with the paper that was on television this week, as evidence that human beings are changing the climate. Every time one of these papers comes out, with all due respect to my colleagues, I have a phone line called the Wonk Line, and it rings in my office. Is it true? Have we been beaten? I read. It's really terrible. I have not found one paper that will support the apocalyptic notion of global climate change in the entire scientific literature. And the people in Washington, I wish they'd get a set of glasses and look at the data. Let's take a look at this paper, which shows human global warming. Now, first of all, this curvy line is a smoothing line. It's not the real data. The jagged line are the summer temperatures inferred from tree rings in the northern hemisphere, and this is supposed to be evidence for anthropogenerated global warming. Well, let's see. Let's take a look here. Oh, look, this is 1980, 70, 60, 50, 40, 30. Oh, my gosh. All the warming was between 1910 and 1930. Nobody picked that up. This is cited as evidence for anthropogenerated warming. No, this has nothing to do with people warming the atmosphere. It says, and as we saw on that warming curve for the northern hemisphere, that somewhere in the early 20th century we escaped from the Little Ice Age and the temperature stabilized since then. Well, all these arguments have had quite an effect. I'll proceed as fast as I can, Fred. I'm moving at the speed of light. New United Nations report kind of fessed up. It said, when the increases in greenhouse gases are taken into account, most climate models produce a greater mean warming than it has been observed to date. That's quite a statement. That never appeared in the press. But that was an admission that the so-called small band of skeptics were right, that too much warming was predicted. The consensus of scientists, the public choice-driven consensus, was forced to admit this a mere 5 years after it said everything was hunky-dory, unless a lower climate sensitivity is used. Now we come to the process of denial. We have to now come up with an excuse that gets the public choice consensus off the hook. There is growing evidence that increases in sulfate aerosols are counteracting the warming due to greenhouse gases. In other words, the products of the combustion of coal and burning of the forest, etc., produce a pall in the atmosphere that reflects solar radiation and compromises the warming that should be being observed. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the last redoubt of the apocalyptics. And when it goes, it's gonna go. That's why this argument, people who go around Washington saying we can't make the science argument, I don't understand. It's over once you knock down the sulfate aerosols. And the sulfate aerosols got knocked pretty hard by your obedient servant. A little while back, Fred's trying to scare me with something that says 5 minutes. It's 5:15. Don't worry, Fred. You don't talk very long.
I've been very good today.
This whole notion was based largely upon an unrefereed paper that went into the United Nations 1995 report that was then published on the 4th of July, 1996, by Ben Santer et al. Ben was the author, what's called the convening lead author of the United Nations chapter on the detection of climate change. So he thought his research was pretty good. And in this paper, he calls his research state of the art. I am always hesitant when somebody writes that they are at the state of the art in science. I think that's a very cheeky thing to do. But what he said was that the atmosphere has increasingly, from 1963 through 1987, grown to resemble an atmosphere in which the greenhouse warming has been compromised by the cooling effect of sulfates. The sulfates are primarily in the northern hemisphere. They only last a few days. So in this argument, the northern hemisphere shouldn't warm very much. The southern hemisphere, which has no sulfates in it, should warm like a banshee, particularly in the free atmosphere away from the surface of the cool ocean. And here is what their computer model said. This is the equator. This is the Antarctica. This is the Arctic. The computer model said this is up. This is 5,000 feet. This is 30,000 feet. The computer model said there should be a massive warming of the atmosphere from 1962 through 1983, particularly in this zone here. And when I saw the result, my first reaction was, this is too good, because no climate model could possibly be this good. This is what happened between 62 and 83. Look at the massive warming egg in the southern hemisphere between 5 and 30,000 feet. That drove what's called the pattern correlation statistic. John Christie, the father of the satellite data, came up to these guys at the meeting where they issued the statement that there was a discernible human influence on the climate and said, if you publish that paper, guys like Michaels are going to walk all over it because I know what happened after 1987, and so do I. Why did this paper stop in 1987, and why did it start in 1963? 1963 was the volcano Agung. It cooled the atmosphere. It started at the cold point. 1987 was a large El Nino. It ended at a warm point. We have weather balloon data from 1958 through today. I'd like you to see all the data, and I'd like you to see the chosen years. This may be shocking to you, but this is what public choice does. This is 1963 through 1987, and the open circles and the solid circles are the entire set of radiosonde data. I make no accusations here because these results speak for themselves. A couple little things, and I'll get off the stage. Hurricanes are becoming more, and they're becoming frequent, they're becoming stronger. You can see that. Here's the record. Ha ha, fooled you. This is the record of news stories that say hurricanes are becoming stronger. A number of newspaper articles that indicated the possibility the hurricanes will become stronger with global warming. And here's the record of hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. This is the weak category 1 and 2 storms, which are by and large beneficial. 72% of all hurricanes are beneficial, 28% are nasty. These are the nasty ones, and there actually is a statistically significant decline in the frequency of nasty hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. Does global warming cause blizzards? The president went to Grand Forks, North Dakota last year during the terrible flood and said, I don't know, a lot of people have noticed an increase in these type of events, and this is what you get from global warming. If anybody knows what caused the Grand Forks flood? Snowfall. It was the melting of a record-heavy snowpack in the Red River Valley that caused the Grand Forks terrible flood. By 1 minute, and very few are left. I will be done in a second. Anyway, here's the temperature history. Now, I realize you need a PhD to know this. This is the relationship between average winter snowfall in Grand Forks and average temperature. Yes, the warmer it is, the less it snows. So, this is the level of disinformation that is being tendered to the American people, by the way. So if you warm up the dry air masses of winter, and Bismarck is darn dry in the winter, what you do is you reduce the probability of a flood like the Grand Forks flood. Or else we could stand in front of Grinnell Glacier, as the vice president did in September, and intone as slowly as possible so you dumb people understand this glacier is melting, and we are the culprit. That's C-U-L-P-R-I-T. Well, glaciers melt in the summer. They melt when the temperature in the summer day goes above freezing. Now, perhaps the vice president could have consulted his federal climatologist to take a look at the temperature out west. I'm almost done. Whoops, that's the temperature in Grand Forks. That's going up. Here's the summer temperature in Glacier National Park. It's not warming. In other words, the melting of Grinnell Glacier was caused by the escape from the Little Ice Age somewhere back here before 1890 and has continued since then. The summer day temperature hasn't changed a lick. I'm done. I will be done with one little more government exaggeration. Newsweek magazine in January, there was a big blizzard in Washington, as you know, and so that was so important that it prompted a cover of Newsweek. And Sharon Begley's horrendous story, blizzards, floods, and hurricanes blame global warming. Things just don't change in Washington, neither this nor this. I would like to close to show you the phenomenal level of distortion that our government exerts upon us. In January of 1997, there was a press release that said that flooding rains have increased by 20% in the country, and this is a result of what you get from global warming. It comes from this paper published by Tom Carl from the National Climatic Data Center. He looked at rainfall between 2 and 3 inches in 24 hours and found that there was an increase in the 20th century in the United States. Our average has gone up from 9% These are relative percents of all rain in the country comes from storms of 2 to 3 inches in 24 hours. It went up 2% to 11% of all rain. Well, I'll close right now, Fred, with a little quantitative discussion. The average rainfall in this country is 30 inches a year, about that much off the table. 9% of 30 inches is 2.7 inches per year. It used to be on the average 2.7 inches of rain came from storms of between 2 and 3 inches. It went up from 9% to 11%. It went up to 3.3 inches. That's this much rain. That much rain never caused a flood, 6-tenths of an inch. But the government produced a press release to scare everybody that it was 20% of all rain, because you see it went from 9% to 11%, and that's 2%, and the average is 10%, and 2 divided by 10 is 20. Welcome to the world of public choice distortion on science. I would argue that if truth is what sets us free, science is the father of the truth. And if science is compromised by this process, freedom is ultimately the victim. Thank you.